Truth Seekers. Mike Malloy here on the Nova M Radio Network. Thank you for joining us this evening. Coming up at 10 o'clock, or, well, an hour from now, 10 o'clock Eastern, we're going to be joined by David Earnhardt. No, not the NASCAR driver. That's Dale. David is the producer or the director of the documentary, The Uncounted, Uncounted, The New Math of American Elections. And by the way, we're going to be giving away a bunch of these DVDs this week. But we're going to talk with David in about an hour. And I think it's appropriate because today the Supreme Court ruled that, well, you know what it ruled about photo ID is perfectly normal, legal, and expected in order to stop voter fraud. You know, the kind of voter fraud where somebody says shows up and says, my name is Joe Blow, and it's really Sam Blow or something like that. No addressing the real voter fraud of stealing elections. We'll get to that later. If you read my mini-blog today, you know that over the next few weeks, we are going to be addressing the issue of 9/11. And, you know, I've struggled with this for going on to 7 years now. And many times people bring it up on this program in kind of a peripheral way or tangential to something else that we're talking about. And my response is usually, yeah, you know, it's like the Kennedy assassination. I wonder if we'll ever know the real truth. Or I will say something to the effect of, well, I don't, you know, I'm not sure what happened, but I sure don't believe the official U.S. government story. And I kind of leave it hanging there. And it always leaves me feeling a little bit like a like an unused marionette, you know, hanging out where everybody else is doing, oh, I don't know, Peter and the Wolf out on stage. Huh? But over the weekend, once again, I started thinking, can't stop thinking, really, but let down the barriers and let all this start to flood in. At the same time, I got a couple of emails from a couple of people whose opinions I really respect about this, and I was not challenged to really consider this, but the question came up in one of the emails, at what point do we really, we being people who consider themselves Americans or patriots or liberals I don't know, maybe a few conservatives too, if they still have any analytical power left inside their mushy brains. But at what point do we as a people, let's do it that way, at what point do we as a people take a real look at what 9/11 was all about? Now, the quick response to that is, well, we've been looking at it for 7 years. We've had lots of experts look at it. But the bottom line has always been, if we did discover the truth, then what? That's always been kind of, sort of, maybe not so kind of, sort of, maybe bullseye. That's been my particular point of view. If we do discover a truth that it would be very difficult for us to deal with, i.e. our government and one other government, the government of Israel, somehow involved, the two governments, rogue elements within those governments. Let me clarify that, because I don't mean to suggest that there's something inherently bad about our government or the government of Israel. And let me clarify that. I'm talking about the way they're essentially constituted. Now, I know a lot of people will argue with me on that one where it concerns Israel and where it concerns the United States. But based on my overview of how societies attempt to govern themselves, I think about the Soviet Union had a great constitution. They just enforced it kind of weirdly. And I think possibly, maybe the same could be said about the state of Israel. Don't send me a copy of their constitution, those, please don't, because I'm sure there's in there somewhere that says Palestinians are dogs. And if I see that, then, you know, I think, oh, Christ, you started off on the wrong foot. But maybe you understand what I'm saying when I say that the governments involved, rogue elements within the government, I don't consider everybody who is in the government of the United States to be an evil son of a bitch. I think there is a handful of policymakers and enforcers who are evil. But I don't think the entire government is evil. So anyway, given all this, I decided to throw caution to the winds and attempt over whatever period of time this turns out to be to invite people on this program, David Ray Griffin, anyone, and I'm open to suggestions here, although I do have kind of a master list of resources that I want to get on this program. We're not going to do this every night, and the nights we do it, unless we have a particularly intriguing guest, we probably will only do it for the first hour, maybe hour and a half. But one never knows when one starts on this sort of a odyssey. I almost said journey, but it's not really a journey. It's like an odyssey. I don't know. I'm lost, and a lot of people like me are lost. It's not that we don't know the truth. It's just that when we reach out to grab the truth, it's like when you're in school and you try, you know, and you were experimenting with mercury, and your physics professor or science professor is trying to explain to you the physical qualities of mercury, and it was like, oh, is it a solid? No, is it a liquid? Woohoo! Of course, not realizing that you were probably making sure that your future children would all be deformed when we played with it. But grabbing a hold of 9/11 is kind of, to me, like that. The crime against us was so monstrous, so unbelievably atrocious. Let's not call it the Reichstag fire. Let's call it something, you know, far, far, far worse than that. Let me quote something for you. This is from forensic anthropologist Clyde Snow. This is from May of 1984, and he was at a meeting in the American Association for the Advancement of Science. This is what he said, quote, "Of all the forms of murder, none is more monstrous than that committed by a state against its own citizens. The homicidal state shares one trait with the solitary killer. Like all murderers, it trips on its own egoism and drops a trail of clues which, when properly collected, preserved, and analyzed, are as damning as a signed confession left in the grave." End quote. Now, I think an awful lot of people, far, far more expert than I in fields such as thermodynamics, structural engineering, intrigues within various intelligence agencies scattered around the world. Experts all over the place have tried and not been successful in the complete sense of that word. They have tried to lay before the American public, and the world for that matter, a series of conclusions. And the conclusions usually point to the fact that what occurred in this country on September 11, 2001 was by no means as it has been advertised and sold to us, the American people. That is, 19 men operating with box cutters, defeating the most sophisticated and most incredibly armed and defended country in the history of mankind, to the extent that the World Trade Centers came down, the Pentagon was attacked, and a mysterious crash or explosion in Pennsylvania occurred that took additional lives. The conclusions that have been drawn don't point toward that scenario. It points completely away from it, over and over and over again. Now, like any of these investigations that play out over a long period of time, you do pick up fringe elements who try to introduce into the equation or into the mystery or into the solution or into the sets of facts nonsense and stuff that doesn't belong there and stuff that's very diversionary and stuff that is injected only to fulfill the injector's particular prejudice or particular ideological belief. We're going to try to stay away from that. We really are. And try to stick to approaching this from the idea that something occurred in this country on September 11, 2001 that was so monstrous that it could only have been done with the assistance of a much larger entity than 19 men with box cutters. Attention. Stand up for what you believe in. Speak up. Tell somebody listen. Shake up the staff.
You're listening to Mike Malloy on Nova M Radio. Turn down your speakers. It'll be our secret.
Past the hour. Okay, correction right away. Thanks, Reg. Israel does not have a written constitution for the obvious reasons. Conflicts with religious law. Okay. Now, as we go along, wherever we go here, any corrections that you folks want to offer, other than Malloy, you're a goddamn freak and idiot. You know, leave this topic alone. Anything other than that, I just, you know, you're not going to convince me otherwise. So. But any corrections along the way would certainly be appreciated. One of the biggest problems, my friend pointed out in the email that started me thinking this weekend, one of the biggest problems in a 9/11 discussion is the Israeli connection. It's very difficult to get into that for the obvious reasons, not the least of which, the matter of fact, the biggest one, is it does tend to bring out the real Jew haters, the people who want to make a case against Judaism rather than deal with the possibility that mutual interests of the United States and Israel may have come together to play a part in what happened on September 11, 2001. So let's talk about the Israeli connection just a little bit. Going to smokingmirrors.blogspot.com, which I quoted today at on my mini-blog, the myriad connections between Israel and 9/11 is tremendous, and no amount of coincidences can account for it. People who have been connected to their country's Secret Service, ex-presidents and high officials in various lands, have said that 9/11 was an inside job, and some have laid the blame at the feet of the CIA and Mossad. The same Israeli security firm was in charge of all 9/11 airports, the London Tube, and the Madrid train station. I can go on and on about dancing Israelis and Odigo. The sheer weight of the evidence is, well, I can't find a word for it. Now, the Odigo, and I guess I'm pronouncing that right, that was the instant messaging firm, and the dancing Israeli stories all show foreknowledge of 9/11 and have been totally ignored or downplayed by mainstream media. We talked about the dancing Israelis a couple of weeks ago on this program, and the dancing Israelis is not as cute or coy a term as it sounds like. We're talking about the Israelis who were photographed and subsequently arrested in New Jersey, I believe. At least that's where the so-called dancing occurred when the 9/11 towers or the trade towers were smoking in a flame. Here's the Odigo story from the Washington Post, 28 September 2001. The headline was "Instant Messages to Israel Warned of World Trade Center Attack." And this is what the Post had to say. Officials at instant messaging firm Odigo confirmed today that two employees received text messages warning of an attack on the World Trade Center 2 hours before terrorists crashed planes into the New York landmarks. Citing a pending investigation by law enforcement, the company declined to reveal the exact contents of the message or to identify the sender. But Alex Diamandis, Vice President of Sales and Marketing, confirmed that workers in Odigo's research and development and international sales office in Israel received a warning from another Odigo user approximately 2 hours prior to the first attack. Diamandis said the sender of the instant message was not personally known to the Odigo employees. Even though the company usually protects the privacy of users, the employees recorded the Internet protocol address of the message's sender to facilitate his or her identification. Soon after the terrorist attacks on New York, the Odigo employees notified their management, who contacted Israeli security services. In turn, the FBI was informed of the instant message warning. FBI officials were not immediately available for comment today. The Odigo service includes a feature called People Finder that allows users to seek out and contact others based on certain interests or demographics. Diamandis said it was possible that the attack warning was broadcast to other Odigo members, but the company has not received reports of other recipients of the message. In addition to operating its own messaging service network, Odigo has licensed its technology to over 100 service providers, portals, wireless carriers, and corporations, according to the company. Now, that's what the Washington Post reported, and, of course, that's the abbreviated version. about 2 weeks after the, well, less than that, actually, about 1 week. Is that right? I can't read tonight, Kathy. About 2 weeks after the attacks. In an address by George Bush on Thursday, September 20th, 2001, and this can be found at whitehouse.gov, Bush said, "Nor will we forget the citizens of 80 other nations who died with our own citizens, more than 130 Israelis." But the New York Times reported 2 days later that Alan Pincus, Israel's general counsel in New York, said that lists of the missing included reports from people who had called in because, for instance, relatives in New York had not returned their phone calls from Israel. There were, in fact, only 3 Israelis who had been confirmed as dead, 2 on the planes, and another who had been visiting the towers on business and who was identified and buried. Now, that's according to the New York Times. Stay with us. We'll be back after the break. I'm Mike Malloy. This is Nova M.
They're all rich and free, but they chained my mind to an endless tomb when they took my only son from me. I saw it on TV. I know it's true. Oh, so true. 'Cause I saw it on.
It's okay, Republicans. The pain will be over soon. Take a deep breath. Find your happy place. It's more of Mike Malloy.
It's about 25 before the hour. Continuing with this is the first night that we're devoting some serious attention to the events of 9/11 as an investigation. My plan here is to lay out the stuff that's available. Staying away from, the real crazy stuff like this was a plot by extraterrestrials who really want to come down here and harvest the human meat that they planted, 500 years ago. So they had to have a diversion and thus the World Trade Center attack. No, we're going to stay away from that. We are at the point where the New York Times reported 2 days after George Bush said more than 130 Israelis died in the bombing of the Twin Trade Towers. The New York Times quoting Alan Pincus, Israel's consul general in New York City. In fact, only 3 Israelis had been confirmed as dead, 2 on the planes and another who had been visiting the towers on business and who was identified and buried. Now, as my correspondent pointed out, here the story begins morphing all over the place. Accounts started popping up about how there should have been hundreds of Israelis at the World Trade Center, but because they had been forewarned, only 1 Israeli died in the towers. Then that Israeli warning turned into something called the Jew call. Do you remember that? Let's get the Jews out because we, being Mossad agents, are about to bomb the World Trade Center. And, of course, that's where it gets crazier and crazier. In Lies and the Lying Liars Who Tell Them, Al Franken, a former colleague at Air America, mentions the story of how all the Jews were warned to stay off planes on 9/11. He states in the book, "I'm a Jew, I never got the call." Well, Franken in that way distorts and discredits the original Odigo story by turning it into an anti-Semitic urban myth. Either, as my correspondent writes, either Franken's a sloppy writer who didn't do his homework by investigating the Odigo story, or he's deliberately planning disinformation. Israel's oldest daily newspaper, Haaretz, published this on their website on September 26, 2001. Odigo says workers were warned of attack. Misha Makover, CEO of the company, said the 2 workers received the messages and immediately after the terror attack informed the company's management, which immediately contacted the Israeli security services, which brought in the FBI. Makover said, quote, "I have no idea why the message was sent to these 2 workers who don't know the sender, It may just have been someone who was joking and turned out they accidentally got it right. And I don't know if our information was useful in any of the arrests the FBI made." End quote. Now, Odigo is a U.S.-based company whose headquarters are in New York with offices in Herzliya in Israel. Now, what I just quoted for you was from Haaretz, the Israeli newspaper. So, a message warning about an attack on the World Trade Center 2 hours before it happened may have been just someone joking around? That's what Mr. Makover said. The odds, of course, against this being a coincidence is off the scale. Now, on to the dancing Israelis who were arrested on that day, September 11th. The New York Times, and you can find this at various websites, whatreallyhappened.com, commondreams.org, informationclearinghouse.info, on and on and on. The New York Times reported that a group of five men had set up video cameras aimed at the Twin Towers prior to the attack on Tuesday and were seen congratulating one another afterwards. Police received several calls from angry New Jersey residents claiming, quote, Middle Eastern, end quote, men with a white van were videotaping the disaster with shouts of joy and mockery. A witness said, "They were like happy, you know, they didn't look shocked to me." They were seen by New Jersey residents on September 11th making fun of the World Trade Center ruins and going to extreme lengths to photograph themselves in front of the wreckage. Witnesses saw them jumping for joy in Liberty State Park after the initial impact. Later on, other witnesses saw them celebrating on a roof in Weehawken, and still more witnesses later saw them celebrating with high fives in a Jersey City parking lot. One of the witnesses said, quote, "It looked like they're hooked in with this. It looked like they knew what was going to happen when they were at Liberty State Park," end quote. One anonymous phone call to the authorities actually led them to close down all of New York's bridges and tunnels. The mystery caller told the 9/11 dispatcher that a group of Palestinians were mixing a bomb inside of a white van headed for the Holland Tunnel. Here's the transcript from NBC News. Dispatcher, Jersey City Police. Caller, "Yes, we have a white van, two or three guys in there. They look like Palestinians, and they're going around a building." Caller, "There's a minivan headed toward the Holland Tunnel. I see the guy by Newark Airport mixing some junk, and he has a sheikh uniform." Dispatcher, "He has what?" Caller, "He's dressed like an Arab." Now, a little note here. Why would this mystery caller specifically say that these Arabs were Palestinians? How would he know that? Palestinians usually dress in Western-style clothes, not in sheikh uniforms. Based on that phone call, police then issued a "Be on the lookout" alert for a white minivan heading for the city's bridges and tunnels from New Jersey. And the warning, white 2000 Chevrolet van with urban moving system sign on the back seen at Liberty State Park, Jersey City, New Jersey, at the time of first impact of jetliner into World Trade Center. Three individuals with van were seen celebrating after initial impact and subsequent explosion. FBI Newark field office requests that if the van is located, hold for prints and detain individuals. That was the alert. Now, when a van fitting that exact description was stopped just before crossing into New York, the suspicious, quote, Middle Easterners, end quote, were apprehended. These terror suspects turned out to be Israelis. According to ABC's 2020, when the van belonging to the cheering Israelis was stopped by the police, the driver of the van, Sivan Kursberg, told the officers, quote, "We are Israelis. We are not your problem. Your problem are our problems. The Palestinians are your problem," end quote. The police and FBI field agents became very suspicious when they found maps of the city with certain places highlighted, box cutters, $4,700 in cash stuffed in a sock, and foreign passports. Police also told the Bergen Record newspaper that bomb-sniffing dogs were brought to the van and that they reacted as if they had smelled explosives. The FBI seized and developed their photos, one of which shows Sivan Kursberg flicking a cigarette lighter in front of the smoldering ruins in an apparently celebratory gesture. The Jerusalem Post later reported that a white van with a bomb was stopped as it approached the George Washington Bridge, but the ethnicity of the suspects was not revealed. Here's what the Jerusalem Post reported on September 12, 2001. Quote, American security services overnight stopped a car bomb on the George Washington Bridge. The van, packed with explosives, was stopped on an approach ramp to the bridge. Authorities suspect the terrorists intended to blow up the main crossing between New York and New Jersey, Army Radio reported. Two suspects are in FBI custody after a truckload of explosives was discovered around the George Washington Bridge. The FBI says enough explosives were in the truck to do great damage to the George Washington Bridge, end quote. What's really intriguing is that ABC's 2020, the New York Post, and the New Jersey Bergen Record newspaper all clearly and unambiguously reported that a white van with Israelis was intercepted on a ramp near Route 3, which leads directly to the Lincoln Tunnel. But the Jerusalem Post, Israeli National News, and Yedioth America all reported just as clearly and unambiguously that a white van with Israelis was stopped on a ramp leading to the George Washington Bridge, which is several miles north of the Lincoln Tunnel. You see the disparity. It appears as if there may actually have been two white vans involved, one stopped on each crossing. This would not only explain the conflicting reports as to the actual location of the arrest, but would also explain how so many credible eyewitnesses all saw celebrating, quote, Middle Easterners, end quote, in a white van in so many different locations. It also explains why the New York Post and Steve Gordon, a lawyer for the five Israelis, originally described how three Israelis were arrested, but later increased the total to five. From there, the story becomes even more suspicious. The Israelis worked for a Weehawken moving company known as Urban Moving Systems. An American employee of Urban Moving Systems told the Record of New Jersey that a majority of his co-workers were Israelis and that they were joking about the attacks. The employee, who declined to give his name, said, quote, "I was in tears. These guys were joking, and that bothered me. These guys were like, now America knows what we go through," end quote. A few days after the attacks, Urban Moving Systems Israeli owner Dominic Suter dropped his business and fled the country for Israel. He was in such a hurry to flee America that some of Urban Moving Systems' customers were left with their furniture stranded in storage facilities. Suter's departure was abrupt, leaving behind coffee cups, sandwiches, cell phones, and computers strewn on office tables, and thousands of dollars of goods in storage. Suter was later placed on the same FBI suspect list as 9/11 lead hijacker Mohammed Atta and other hijackers and suspected al-Qaeda sympathizers, suggesting that U.S. authorities felt Mr. Suter may have known something about the attacks. We'll be back after the break. I'm Mike Malloy. This is Nova M.
Reality Radio for a Rational World. The Mike Malloy Show, only on Nova M Radio.
10 before the hour. Well, it's interesting already the emails I'm getting from people who are turning off the program and telling me I'm out of my mind and nothing happened except what happened. I'll say it again. What we're looking for is some rational explanations for what happened on that that horrible day. If the program that we're doing tonight or that we're going to do subsequent programs about this topic turns you off, that's fine. That's why you have an on-off switch on your radio. It's okay with me. I would think that you might be interested in sticking around because I've not made any declarations It's interesting to me when I bring up the topic, just bringing up the topic, and so far laying out nothing but what has already been reported in very reliable news sources, whether it is Haaretz or the Jewish Forward or New York Times or Washington Post. Okay, I know they're not really reliable news sources, but that already... I'm starting to get the flames, you know, like, surely, Mike, someone as smart as you. I've listened to you for a long time. I'm not going to listen again. What is it about this topic that freaks you out? Why is it because you think everyone who doesn't accept the official story is a nut? I don't think I'm a nut. I think I'm a rather rational human being. Let's continue. The Jewish Weekly, The Forward, reported that the FBI finally concluded that at least two of the detained Israelis were agents working for the Mossad, the Israeli intelligence agency, and that the Urban Moving Systems, the ostensible owner of the five Israelis, employer of the five Israelis, was a front operation. Let me say it again. The American Jewish Weekly paper, The Forward, reported that the FBI finally concluded that at least two of the detained Israelis were agents working for Mossad, the Israeli intelligence agency, and that Urban Moving Systems, the ostensible employer of the five Israelis, was a front operation. This was confirmed by two former CIA officers, and they noted that movers' vans are a common intelligence cover. The Israelis were held in custody for 71 days before being quietly released. Christopher Ketchum wrote in Counterpunch on March 7, 2007, quote, "The former CIA counterterrorism officer who spoke anonymously told me that FBI investigators determined that the suspect Israelis were serving as Arabic-speaking linguists running technical operations in northern New Jersey's extensive Muslim communities. The former CIA officer said the operations included taps on telephones, placement of microphones in rooms, and mobile surveillance. The source at ABC News agreed, quote, "Our conclusion was that they were Arab linguists involved in monitoring operations, in other words, electronic surveillance. People at FBI concur with this," end quote. The ABC News source added, quote, "What we heard was that the Israelis may have picked up chatter that something was going to happen on the morning of 9/11, end quote. The former CIA counterterrorism officer told me, quote, "There was no question but that the order to close down the investigation came from the White House. It was immediately assumed at CIA headquarters that this basically was going to be a cover-up so that the Israelis would not be implicated in any way in 9/11. Bear in mind that this was a political issue, not a law enforcement or intelligence issue. If somebody says we don't want the Israelis implicated in this, we know that they've been spying the hell out of us. We know that they possibly had information in advance of the attacks, but this would be a political nightmare to deal with," end quote. Several of the detainees discussed their experience in America on an Israeli talk show after the return home, said one of the men, denying that they were laughing or happy on the morning of September 11th, quote, "The fact of the matter is, we are coming from a country that experiences terror daily. Our purpose was to document the event," end quote. How did they know there would be an event to document on 9/11? So there you have the two big Israeli Mossad stories. And as my correspondent wrote, they belong in the foreknowledge section of the 9/11 story, along with Buzzy Krongard and the mysterious put options on American and United Airlines. And also this, on September 10th, Newsweek has learned a group of top Pentagon officials suddenly canceled travel plans for the next morning, apparently because of security concerns. That's in Newsweek, the day before. From the San Francisco Chronicle, Willie Brown got a low-key warning about air travel. For Mayor Willie Brown, the first signs that something was amiss came late Monday the day before, when he got a call from what he described as his airport security, a full 8 hours before yesterday's string of terrorist attacks, advising him that Americans should be cautious about their air travel. And May 17, 2002, Pacifica Radio reported that Condoleezza Rice was the source of the call to Brown. From CBSNews.com, quote, in response to inquiries from CBS News over why John Ashcroft was traveling exclusively by leased jet aircraft instead of commercial airlines, the Justice Department cited what it called a, quote, threat assessment, end quote, by the FBI, and said Ashcroft has been advised to travel only by private jet for the remainder of his term. And on and on and on. Stay with us. We'll be back. I'm Mike Malloy. This is Nova M. Seven past the hour. This is the Malloy Program on Nova M Radio. We're going to talk here in just a minute to David Earnhardt. He's the director of a documentary called The Uncounted. I'm sorry, Uncounted, not The Uncounted, just Uncounted. The New Math of American Elections? ? Now, I got an email from one of the people associated with the film today, Mary, who writes, even as a judge in New Jersey gives the go-ahead to crack open a review of the state's failed touchscreen electronic voting machines, Florida's Republican governor has decided to begin enforcing strict deadlines and fines up to $1,000 for groups that lose voter registration forms or turn them in late. This has stopped the nonpartisan League of Women Voters registration drive dead in its tracks. Now, what we want to do here is try to get some information out about Uncounted, and what better person to do that than David Earnhardt. David, the director. David, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Mike.
We received a bunch of the DVDs, and this week, David, we're going to be giving them away. And I have to tell you, at this point, I have not watched the film. But I understand that what you've put together here shows how the election fraud, according to the notes, the election fraud that changed the outcome of the 2004 election led to even greater fraud in 2006 and is now kind of standing there waiting for 2008. Tell us what the film is essentially about.
Well, really, as much as anything, we're just trying to get this issue on the table, that the basic crux of the movie is that our election system just doesn't work very well, that millions of people's votes go uncounted in major election after major election, and it just keeps getting worse. It's either through voter suppression, where people want to vote, but for various reasons aren't allowed to vote, or for problems with these electronic voting machines that just have a terrible lack of security to them. And, you know, what we really show, particularly in the last decade, is that the vast majority of these uncounted votes, particularly, you know, since 2000, have gone you know, have gone against Democratic candidates. And mm-hmm. you know, for example, I mean, I think most of us know that President Bush wouldn't have been elected in 2000. Maybe less people realize how much this was a factor in 2004, which we focus on quite a bit, that he wouldn't have been elected then had the votes been counted fairly.
Right.
So that's really what we're trying to do is a warning shot for 2008, is let's pay attention to this issue, because it probably is the single largest thing that will determine who mm-hmm. is going to be our next president, and we just have to pay attention to this. We have to get this issue on the table.
Isn't it ironic, then, given the Supreme Court ruling today that that rejected a challenge to Indiana's voter identification law, which I understand is the most restrictive in the country. We have it here in Georgia that requires photo IDs for everyone who goes to vote. And the whole thing was put together based on the idea of election fraud, that the Democrats were sending people into polling places using different names and voting for Democratic candidates. So the Republicans in these various states have set up a fail-safe system now. You must have a photo ID, which obviously that's going to make it difficult for certain segments, certain demographic of the Democratic Party base, you might say, to get a chance to vote.
Absolutely.
Isn't this kind of insane?
Oh, I think it's crazy. It's scary because it opens up the door for many more states to follow suit and do this kind of thing. And this is a very partisan thing that's going on. I mean, you really nailed it. It tends to be Republican legislatures that are looking at enacting these laws, and it is hurting primarily Democratic voters. Now, you know, I mean, this is really, I guess, what you could really call it is a new Jim Crow, but I thought it was real interesting. The Brennan Center, who's done so much great work on this whole issue, they have uncovered no voter fraud case ever mm-hmm. prosecuted against someone who impersonated another voter at the polls. I mean, this is a law that is being put into place for a problem that doesn't exist. And what it's going to do, it's going to disenfranchise many voters in state after state. You know, I read another thing that said that, you know, as many as 20 million people lack the kind of identification that would be required by this Indiana law. Most of them, minorities and the elderly, who don't have driver's license or passports, and just many of whom will not be able to afford the cost of obtaining the documentation to apply for this kind of identification. And that's going to disenfranchise people. It's going to suppress the vote. And most of these voters are going to be Democratic voters. And that's the real game going on in 2008, is holding down the vote through laws like this. And it's you're right. It's insane. It's scary. And we need to be raising a lot of hell about it.
Now, Uncounted has a series of screenings across the country. Tell us when some of those dates are.
Yeah, well, the big one, you know, that affects, many of your listeners is the one we're doing in Chicago tomorrow night at Landmark Century Center Cinema.
Mm-hmm.
Me tomorrow night at 7:00, and radio station that carries your show right there, many of whom are listening right now, is WCPT. They've been a promotion partner with us there. And I'll be there, as well as Bob Kohler, who's a Tribune Media columnist from Chicago, and also in our film, and answer questions and that sort of thing. And that's kind of what we're doing in city after city. Chicago is our 23rd city that we've gone to in the last 3 months, started in mid-January. I think Mary Mancini, our co-producer, who wrote to you, she called it the do-it-yourself type approach to film distributing. I mean, it's working. We're basically going to cities, doing one-night-only showings. We're attracting 200 or 300 people to the table, probably half of whom don't really understand this issue.
Mm-hmm.
And when they see this film, they get mad, which is really the point of the whole thing, is to get this issue, get people seeing it, and when people understand more about this issue, that people are being disenfranchised, that the vote isn't getting properly counted, they want to do something. And that's what we're trying to do, is take it directly to people so that people can get out the word to other people, because we just can't wait for the media to get the word out. Progressive radio has been doing a good job, but the mainstream media is just really not getting the word out on this. And so we're trying to – why we did the film, was to try to get this issue out there.
There is a website, uncountedthemovie.com, uncountedthemovie.com. Why is there not a major film distributor handling this, or is there?
Well, we are in... It will work out. I mean, we're going to get somebody who will help us with the DVD end of things. You know, it's a tough road for documentaries in general,
sure.
especially political documentaries, to get widespread theatrical. And we just decided that we couldn't wait. We just needed to go forward with this. And, you know, so you know, it's and also this issue. Is not, you know, it's not the easiest sell, although when people learn about it, they do care a lot about it. So I've just been pleased that we've been able to get it in front of people, and people have shown up. And, you know, part of the key has been when we go to cities, we engage the local election integrity groups that are doing work on this issue, get them to work with us. It's an opportunity for them to meet with new people, and then for the people that come to the movie who are just, I'm telling you, when people see this, they want to do something, and these groups offer an opportunity for people to do something. So the Illinois Ballot Integrity Project is who is hosting us in Chicago, so we're really excited about that.
How involved in either critiquing or distributing or promoting your film is the Democratic Party?
Well, you know, the Democratic Party, as you probably know, is just, this issue makes them nervous, and it's really such a strategic mistake on their part from my standpoint. Now, we've had different people who have worked with us, you know, Representative John Conyers is in the film. I mean, he's been on this issue big time. And our own local Congressman Jim Cooper is in the film and has done a lot of good work with us. But, you know, like, for example, this ruling that came down, I'd really like to see, you know, the Obama campaign put out a release about this and take a stand, because they are going to be hurt by this.
What do you mean by nervous? The Democratic Party. What do you mean when you say the Democratic Party is nervous about this issue?
What you will hear people say, what you'll hear the leadership say a lot of times, is that to make too big a deal out of this issue will cause people to say, "Well, I'm not going to vote. My vote's not going to count." That has not been my experience when I've been out there. I mean, when people learn that this issue is going on, that the vote is being disrespected like this, it makes people more vigilant about voting. It brings even more motivation to people wanting to get out there. And I think this is an issue just waiting for, and really it's not the Democrats or, this is one of those issues that really everybody can get on the same table about. Now, you know, much of the manipulation of the last 10 years, almost all of it, has gone in one direction, against the Democrats.
Right.
But if you look at the course of our entire history of our country, this issue has always been with us. I mean, you've had the big party, you know, political machines in, you know, Chicago and in the South, the Democratic Party. It's gone both ways over the course of history. It's really more a matter of who is in power, on who's in the best position to manipulate the political machinery. So this issue is something that is ultimately a nonpartisan issue that can pull everybody together. And when I show this thing, it's not just the Dems and the progressives and the independents to respond to it. The Republicans, the bulk of them, they get mad too.
I hear you.
This is something that pulls us all together.
David, I'm going to be giving away boku copies of your DVD later on this week. Thanks so much.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate your support.
All right. Take care, David.
Thank you, Mike.
All right, go to the website, uncountedthemovie.com. We'll be right back.
Way you talk when you walk that walk. talk that talk. You knocks me out.
Faster than a flying monkey, more powerful than a special prosecutor. It's Mike Malloy on Nova M Radio.
24 past the hour. Yeah, the Supreme Court ruled today that the Indiana voter identification law was not unconstitutional. It was not an impediment to voting at all. People for the American Way has put out a press release regarding it. It says the Supreme Court has abdicated its role as the defender of our democracy. And water is wet. No, I added that. The justices should clear the path to the ballot box for voters, not help block the way. Voter ID laws are intended to suppress voter turnout. If voter ID advocates were truly interested in fixing our election system, they'd be working to make elections verifiable and end deceptive practices that keep people from the polls. Democracy only works when all eligible voters can actually cast a ballot. The justices are letting politicians erect barricades against some groups of voters, and that's absolutely unacceptable. The threat of voter fraud is a ruse. Study after study shows that there is no widespread in-person fraud by voters in this country. But there are millions of eligible voters who don't have the ID these laws require. These laws throw up barriers that keep people away from the polls. That's from People for the American Way. Yeah, the whole idea, I think, behind this, of course, is obviously to suppress the vote. Most people who vote in America, let me rephrase that. Most people in America are either Democrats or progressives or liberals, because we know what happens when conservatives or Republicans take power. Jesus Christ, just look at the past 8 years, 7 years. These whiny bastards have been yelping and screeching like five-year-olds with one thumb in their mouth and the other in their butt for how many years about, well, just let us get power, we'll fix things. Well, they've had all the power for the past 7 years. What have they done? Conservatism, corporatism, right-wingism, neo-Nazism, American fascism, whatever you want to call it, is absolutely a failed form of self-government if the idea is self-government. It is what the Republicans are trying to impose, what the conservatives are trying to impose, is a form of totalitarianism that brooks no nonsense from anything like a opposition party, even though the opposition party in this country is about as oppositional as, I don't know, somebody quick, give me a metaphor. You know, it's not oppositional at all. But for the Supreme Court and for Justice John Paul Stevens, isn't he a liberal? Or am I thinking of someone else? Or is it Kennedy? Anthony Kennedy? Oh, I don't know. Sammy the Fish Alito and Clarence Bozo Thomas and Antonin Fat Tony Scalia and John, here's a stick in your eye, Roberts and Anthony Kennedy and John Paul Stevens all voted saying, nah, it's no problem. It's no problem. Barack Obama said that he disagreed with the decision. He says it discourages folks from voting. Yeah, it does, but isn't that the whole idea? Are you pissed off enough yet? No? Okay, stick around. I'm Mike Malloy. This is Nova M.
Your brother's keeper just don't apply, 'cause it's everybody for himself.
to bed angry. Let Mike Malloy do it for you on Nova M Radio.
It's about 25 before the hour. I got an interesting little email here from Prairie 2 regarding 9/11. And I know a lot of people want to talk about this, and we're going to try to work your phone calls in on a, you know, on kind of an ongoing basis. Again, I'm not inclined to spend the entire 3 hours of every program that I bring this topic up discussing this topic for a number of reasons, not the least of which I just don't want to get involved in all kinds of points of views and theories. We're going to have experts, people I consider to be experts on this, people who have gathered a lot of information. You may consider them to be crackpots. But we're going to have these people on. So we may not take very many calls on 9/11 tonight. But email here from Prairie 2 is kind of interesting. He says, Mike, two of the biggest buildings ever built, those are the twin towers, designed before computer simulation, they were built much stronger than buildings are today. The architect has said that they estimated the impact of a Boeing 707 and the resulting fuel fire, and then they doubled that. A B-24 having hit the Empire State Building, this was a real concern. Even if the towers were so poorly built that neither building lived up to its design specs, then why did Building 7, a huge building in its own right, fall down for no apparent reason? Large buildings all over the world should be raining down on a regular basis. Yet no steel frame skyscraper has ever collapsed in over 100 years. Despite earthquakes and hurricanes, some have burned to gutted shells, but none has ever collapsed. Three collapse in one day. Two from damage they were designed to easily withstand, and the third, well, just because it felt like it. If this were true, why are any large buildings still in use? The existing populations would be exhorted to stay in the center of the street and walk softly. Yeah. In Birmingham, Alabama, sometimes I just, you know, people ask me, why do you live here in the South? Why do you live in the South, Malloy? Why don't you get out of there? Those people are crazy. Yeah, but there's something about the craziness that is just so damned entertaining. It really is. This is from Birmingham, Alabama. That city has a worsening homicide rate. Folks over there, it's not quite like Chicago, but it's getting bad on, you know, Birmingham standards. Most murders and crimes of violence occur in the South anyway, here in the Bible Belt. But the mayor of Birmingham... Excuse me. The mayor of Birmingham has a novel idea. He is asking the city's reverends and pastors, all the, I don't know, the Protestants, Catholics, I don't know, mostly Christians, I guess, some Jews, I don't know. He's asking the pastors and citizens to, he asked last Friday, to put on burlap sacks and ashes in an Old Testament-style sign of biblical repentance. That's right. Mayor Larry Langford said his sackcloth and ashes rally at Boutwell Auditorium was inspired by the book of Jonah, where residents of the ancient city of Nineveh wore rough fabric and ashes as a sign of turning away from sin. A pastor who helped organize the rally said Mayor Langford bought 2,000 burlap bags that apparently were handed out at the event. The reverend, I guess his name is Green, he says, we believe things have begin to dramatically change when the mayor calls for prayer. I don't think there's ever been a city called to sackcloth and ashes. Nineveh? Since he took office last year, Mayor Langford has held three prayer rallies as a way of addressing crime and violence. Apparently it's not working. Bibles were handed out at one of the events. Langford, Mayor Langford, is a professing Christian. A professing Christian. Said, quote, this city needs to humble itself, end quote. So far this year, 27 people have been killed in Birmingham compared to 19 at the same time last year. But they started praying last year. Well, you folks have apparently just pissed off God mightily, so he's going to kill as many of you as he feels like it, but it's already half again as many as last year, right? The mayor's prayer rallies may run the potential of creating a dispute over church-state separation, according to Olivia Turner, who's director of the ACLU in Alabama. Ms. Turner, there is no church-state separation in Alabama in the Republican Party. It doesn't exist. Are you seriously? The Reverend Vernon Hughley, pastor of Our Lady Queen of the Universe Catholic Church, says he doesn't see a problem with the mayor calling for prayer. He said, quote, "I believe they need to bring their faith into their profession. We've got to do something. We've been done in the past. What we've done in the past has not worked. This is something new," end quote. Well, wait a minute, Reverend, or Father Hughley. Birmingham city officials have turned to prayer in the past. And, you know, for the city's crime problems, doesn't seem to work. Y'all need to pray over there. I mean, really pray hard. Do like they say Jesus did in the garden, you know, pray until you have beads of blood on your forehead. If you can't do that, give it up. Seriously, give it up. The former police chief in Birmingham promoted the idea of turning people toward God to quell the violence in the city's neighborhoods. The current police chief has a lengthy resume that includes being an ordained minister. Okay, well, listen, y'all in Birmingham, just keep us posted. Let us know how that prayer thing goes, okay? Praying for gas, praying for corn, praying for sackcloth and ashes. Sackcloth and ashes. I think what the mayor and the city council and the chief of police and the Christians who are serious about this, I mean, prayer and sackcloth and ashes is okay, but what you really need to do is get into some real heavy-duty self-flagellation. I want to see some whips, some cat-o'-nine-tails with fish hooks on it, and strip down to one of those little loincloth things and just walk through the streets of Birmingham beating the hell, literally, out of your own backs. You know, just... you know, just flail yourself. Now, if that, you know, sackcloth and ashes, God's going to look down and say, what, Halloween? What's going on? What's this? What's up? What are you people doing now? Sackcloth and ashes, that Nineveh thing. Didn't impress me 2,000 years ago, doesn't impress me now. What else you got? And I'm suggesting to the citizens of Birmingham, if you really, really are serious about this, get into the beating yourselves with those cats and nine tails with fish hooks embedded all up and down those leather things. I understand it's cleansing. Oh, man, we live in very strange times. Christy Todd Whitman is off the hook. She's a former head of the EPA. A federal appeals court ruled a couple of days ago that she can't be held responsible for telling people in New York near the burning World Trade Centers after the 2001 attacks that the air was safe to breathe. And as a result of that, thousands upon thousands, nobody will know because people will still be suffering from this long after Christy Todd Whitman is nothing but a memory to her family. But thousands of people were exposed because the Bush crime family told Christy Todd Whitman to tell everybody it's okay to go back there so we can get Wall Street cranked up again. Problem's over. No big deal. A couple of buildings came down. Don't anybody get their panties in a wad. A couple of buildings came down. Go, go, go. 3 days after the attack of September 11th, Christy Todd Whitman told reporters, quote, "The good news continues to be that air samples we have taken all have been at levels that cause us no concern," end quote. And on September 18th, a week later, she assured residents that the air, quote, "is safe to breathe and the water is safe to drink," end quote. Whitman later testified in congressional hearings, of course, that she was talking about the air of lower Manhattan. Generally, not ground zero specifically. What's wrong with you? Gerald Nadler, Democrat in New York, who held hearings on the federal government's management of the crisis at which Whitman testified, said, quote, "She caused thousands of residents, workers, and first responders to suffer injury and in some cases death due to unnecessary exposure to toxins released by the collapse of the World Trade Center buildings." Well, too bad. Federal Appeals Court, which is where the Republicans have ensconced the neo-Nazis to the greatest degree, Federal Appeals Court reversed U.S. District Judge Deborah Batt's decision in February 2006, which allowed a lawsuit against Whitman to proceed. Judge Batt at the time called Whitman's actions, quote, conscience-shocking. The judge went on to say no reasonable person would have thought that telling thousands of people that it was safe to return to lower Manhattan while knowing that such return could pose long-term health risks and other dire consequences was conduct sanctioned by our laws, she wrote. Well, Christy Todd is off the hook. And I swear to God, that is good news.
Redefining Anger Management. It's Mike Malloy, only on Nova M Radio.
Oh my goodness, I was just reading, LaShonda sent me an email here from a link to Birmingham Blues. Apparently the mayor of Birmingham says a charity Birmingham Mayor Larry Langford created more than 7 years ago to give every child a computer faces scrutiny from a donor and federal prosecutors over its use of more than $1 million in taxpayer money, including payments on personal credit card bills, expenses for elaborate trips, and checks written to a star of gay porn films. The questions about computer help for kids, created in 2000 to carry out Langford's first Computer for Every Child promise as Fairfield mayor, the charges come as the Birmingham City Council considers an agreement allowing a new charity backed by Langford to distribute computers to students. Blah, blah, blah. It just goes on and on and on. Man, it just never fails. Thanks, LaShonda. It never fails to amaze me. Or I'm sure you. Regarding the ancient city of Nineveh, where they put on sackcloth and ashes, Roz reminds me that Nineveh is the present city of Mosul in Iraq. And didn't the U.S. bomb the hell out of Mosul a couple of times? Yeah, I think so. From our military correspondent, Sharon, this comes from vetvoice.org. Dick Cheney's prediction is about to come true. On August 2000, before the election, Dick Cheney said this. For 8 years, Clinton and Gore have extended our military commitments while depleting our military power. Rarely has so much been demanded of our armed forces and so little given to them in return. George W. Bush and I are going to change that, too. I've seen our military at its finest, with the best equipment, the best training, and the best leadership. I'm proud of them. I've had the responsibility for their well-being, and I can promise them now help is on the way. Soon, our men and women in uniform will once again have a commander-in-chief they can respect, one who understands their mission and restores their morale. Now, if someone were to compile a list of the 100 most ironic comments ever made in human history, this remark in 2000 undoubtedly would be in the top half. Now, if you fast forward, Brandon Friedman sent me this. If you fast forward nearly 8 years, we get reports like this. This is from the NationalJournal.com. The once mighty king of battle is a dead branch walking, write the active duty colonels in a 5-page document obtained by National Journal. With growing alarm, they describe deterioration in artillery readiness to perform its most basic missions. In training, firing incidents occur almost every rotation. Crew drills are very slow, and any type of disorder halts operations. And absent instructor intervention, most cannon platoons would have fired it in unsafe conditions, the memo says. The wars in Iraq and Afghanistan have drawn experienced artillery troops into other jobs like infantry and transportation, where soldiers are badly needed, the authors write. 90% of fire support personnel have been reassigned, leaving behind fewer than 10% certified for the mission. Less than 2 weeks ago, the AP reported, quote, U.S. soldiers are committing suicide at record levels. Young officers are abandoning their military careers, and the heavy use of force in Iraq has made it harder for the military to fight conflicts that could arise elsewhere. Unprecedented strains on the nation's all-volunteer military are threatening the health and readiness of the troops. Less than a month before that, Army Chief of Staff Richard Cody testified before Congress, quote, given the current theater demand for Army forces, we are unable to provide a sustainable tempo of deployments for our soldiers and families. Soldiers, family support systems, and equipment are stretched and stressed by the demands of lengthy and repeated deployments with insufficient recovery time. Equipment used repeatedly in harsh environments is wearing out more rapidly than programmed. Army support system designed for the pre-9/11 peacetime army are straining under the accumulation of stress from 6 years of war. Overall, our readiness is being consumed as fast as we build it. And according to the Washington Post, Cody even went so far as to say the following, quote, I've never seen our lack of strategic depth be where it is today, end quote. These are troubling times for the U.S. military, having been so poorly led and administered by an incompetent commander-in-chief who has surrounded himself with hopelessly inept advisors. We now find ourselves in a situation quite the opposite of what Dick Cheney predicted in 2000. But while most of what he said is depressingly laughable 8 years later, he did utter something that holds true now more than ever. He said, I can promise help is on the way. Soon our men and women in uniform will once again have a commander-in-chief they can respect, one who understands their mission and restores their morale. So true, Dick. Once George W. Bush is removed from office and once John McCain is defeated in his run for the presidency, we'll have exactly that. It's just too bad that we had to go through 8 years and two wars to finally reach this point. From our military affairs correspondent, Sharon Gordy. All right, we're coming up on a break here, so we're going to take that. We'll do that. We'll come back and take some phone calls. And we have some more things to drop into the mix. Oh, did you hear that Hamid Karzai, our puppet in Afghanistan, they almost got him. When was it? Yesterday? Monday? Yesterday over there. Three people killed. They were having a... Well, I'll tell you about when we come back. The irony in this story is almost palpable, too. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. This is Nova M Radio.
place together. It's the music to the story in your eyes. It's been shining down.
It's about 7 past the hour. Yeah, President Harmon Karzai. This is the Malloy program, I'm sorry, on Novum Radio. Harmon Karzai and his fake government cabinet ministers and generals and foreign diplomats were all out for a demonstration of the wonderful security and progress that has been made as a result of our involvement with Harmon Karzai in this war against the Taliban. And again, I'm not sure why we're in that war at all. If the people who carried out 9/11, if you believe the official story, all headed for Afghanistan or the badlands between Afghanistan and Pakistan, you know, maybe a policing action. Oh, never mind. Anyway, all these guys were out. There was live coverage on state television. People died. Two MPs slumped in their seats. This was seen on television. One, only about 30 meters from Karzai. One died later, as did a minority leader and a 10-year-old little girl. Television coverage was cut as rockets exploded. Uniformed bandsmen and some soldiers joined hundreds of others scrambling to safety. And then Karzai appeared on television about an hour later, assuring Afghans that he was alive and appealing for calm. Among the foreign officials in the reviewing stand with U.S. and British ambassadors and the commander of international forces in Afghanistan, General Dan McNeil, they escaped unhurt. The envoy from the U.K. was standing in the front row. This was supposed to be a celebration of, like I said, the wondrous things that have occurred under the Harmon Karzai government. Taliban claim responsibility, saying the attack disproved NATO claims that the insurgency in that country was weakening. A Taliban spokesman said, quote, three of our attackers have been killed and three managed to escape. Small arms and rocket-propelled grenades were used in the attack. The statement went on to say, Afghan and NATO authorities this year repeatedly said the Taliban are on the verge of annihilation. Now it has been proved to them the Taliban not only have the ability to operate in the provinces, but even in Kabul. The attackers fired from a three-story building overlooking the parade ground, which is opposite Kabul's largest mosque. And the military event today, or when this attack occurred, was on the 16th anniversary of the victory of Mujahideen fighters over the Soviet-backed communist government. Of course, the Mujahideen fighters were led, or at least to some degree influenced by our asset there at the time, Osama bin Laden. Just amazing. Just amazing. The attack on Iran is apparently is absolutely going to happen. Dave Lindorf, one of my favorite writers, writing at smirkingchimp.com, says it looks like the attack is coming soon. The Washington Post's Ann Scott Tyson is today reporting in an article headlined Joint Chiefs Chairman Says U.S. Preparing Military Options Against Iran that the U.S. military is not stretched too thin to take on Iran. Iran is becoming an increasingly lethal and malign influence in Iraq. Yeah, we talked about this Friday, I think. The Persian Gulf is now crammed full of U.S. attack ships ranging from a missile-armed nuclear sub to aircraft carriers packed with Tomahawk cruise missiles and fleets of attack aircraft larger than most nations' entire air forces, and they're also equipped with nuclear weapons. And, of course, one of the signposts to this imminent attack is the pushing out of Admiral William Fallon as commander, Central Command Chief, and his replacement with Askisser David Petraeus, who is widely, essentially, seen as a yes man for Bush and Cheney. So with oil prices hitting $122 a barrel, on the verge of a serious global recession, and here in the United States, it's going to get worse. That figure will be doubled the minute any U.S. attack on Iran begins. That's because war with Iran would immediately bring an oil, bring all oil shipments through the Persian Gulf, which is about 25% of the world's oil, to a halt. And even if not one tanker were sunk, no insurer would cover a tanker in that region. Moreover, Iranian sappers and their allies in Turkey, Iran, and Saudi Arabia could be expected to take out vulnerable pipelines, refineries, and wellheads in retaliation to any attack. So an attack on Iran would mean global economic collapse. Yeah, it's madness, but it's predictable madness. If they could pull off 9/11, and this is the thing that is so shocking to me, and why I simply do not understand, and I don't. I'm not trying to be coy here by any stretch of the imagination. Being coy is not, you know, not what I do. But everything we're going through right now, all the security measures that screw everything up, the destruction of the Constitution, the powers assembled in the unitary executive branch, so-called, all the death in Afghanistan and Iraq, what's going on in Palestine, the raping and pillaging of the American economy, everything, every single thing, everything that is screwing up not just the declining dollar, the enormous debt we're in to the Chinese, all of it, every single bit of it, funnels back to the events of 9/11. All of it. And the events of 9/11 prior to 9/11 were, I don't want to say predicted, but they were almost advocated for. What the United States needs is another Pearl Harbor. Who said that? Was that Project for a New American Century? Who... was that some of the neocon warmongers who demanded that Clinton invade Iraq, and he said no? And then that was in what, 97, 98, 96? And then the plans were put into play. Understand one thing. The people who truly believe the 9/11 story as presented by the government, the U.S. government, how to say it without pissing some of you off? Let me try. The events of 9/11 were the watershed. Is that the word I'm looking for? The source of everything that came after. Is there someone out there among us, and I know the answer is, well, hell yes, who really believes that none of this is connected, that the attack on the World Trade Center was not a planned event, not necessarily planned. I'm not saying it was planned by the U.S. government. I don't know, maybe it was, but I'm not making that claim. I'm not making the claim that our intelligence agencies and Mossad, the Israeli intelligence agency, they all sat down and said, okay, let's figure out a way to really pump the fire up the ass of the United States. No, I'm not saying that at all. What I am saying at this point, I don't know, that may be the truth. I don't know. But I am saying this, that the events that occurred in this country on September 11, 2001 were known in advance. Maybe not all the exact specific details, and even that I'm not so sure of. But they were known in advance. And the Bush crime family and anyone else involved, I don't care if it was Mossad or MI5 or the Soviet or the Russian, you know, I don't give a good goddamn who else was involved. But if you want me to believe that all of this stuff occurred as presented then you want me to believe something I simply will not.
People dying never told. It's all a part of playing God, so you think we need them. While being Ashcroft, take away your rights to freedom. Bear witness to the sickness of these dictators. Hope you understand the time, brother, because it's major.
What would you do if you do?
Let Mike Malloy do it for you on Nova M Radio.
This is kind of interesting. The fake president of Afghanistan, our little puppet, Hamid Karzai. You remember last week? He was sharply critical of the U.S. and British handling of the war in Afghanistan. He cited the arrest of alleged Taliban militants and sympathizers by the U.S. military, saying such efforts were doing little to minimize violence in Afghanistan. This was on Saturday. New York Times reported this. Karzai also said coalition forces focused on Afghan villages rather than militant sanctuaries in Pakistan were not impacting the ongoing war on terror. And instead of such security efforts, Karzai suggested U.S. and British officials should refocus their efforts in Afghanistan by supporting the country and helping with rebuilding efforts. Karzai said, quote, for the success of the world in Afghanistan, it would be better to recognize this inherent character in Afghanistan and work with it and support it. Eventually, if the world is to succeed in Afghanistan, it will be by building the Afghan state, not by keeping it weak. And then, I don't know, count it, 48 hours later, he got whacked. Or they tried to whack him. Now, of course, that was just the Taliban. And of course, all that security and all the NATO forces and all that could not stop these so-called militants or Taliban or whatever they are from setting up a military command post 300 meters from everybody and opening fire. Huh? Just a coincidence, that's all. Move on, there's nothing here to look at. Go! Hamid Karzai criticizes his overlords, and within 72 hours, he almost gets murdered! Well! This is from Raging Lefty, who writes, Dear Mike, when I first heard someone say that 9/11 was an inside job, I thought it was preposterous. But I changed my mind when I discovered that Remember the Maine was a lie, Gulf of Tonkin was a lie, Gulf War was a lie, why did Japan attack Hawaii? The U.S. was embargoing Japan's oil supply, voila! A provoked attack was conveniently provided to justify the entrance into World War II. Everyone in the 9/11 truth movement has a tipping point that throws them against the wall, and they have an epiphany. They realize the U.S. government was involved in 9/11. Perhaps your listeners may want to share their tipping point. If we, the people, cannot face that fact, the fact that we live in an illusion, then the atrocities will continue and billions will die. Well, that certainly may be the case, right? Let's go to your phone calls. You want to do that? Sure, let's do that. Who's first? John is calling from Philadelphia. John, your last name is up here. Did you want your last name?
Yeah, that's fine, Mike. How you doing?
I'm fine. John Gold? Is that
your name? Yeah, John Gold. The reason I was calling, you had mentioned several things, obviously. Two things I want to point out. The Christy Todd Whitman debacle.
Mm-hmm. Right.
My good friend John Feel, who's the founder of the Feel Good Foundation, you know, says it ever so eloquently when he says that she belongs in prison for manslaughter.
Yeah, I can go along with that, sure.
The other thing is, I don't know if your listeners are aware, with regard to the 9/11 issue in September 2006, representatives of the family members got together at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C.,
mm-hmm.
and called for a new investigation into the attacks, and the media did not cover them. This past February, after the news about Philip Zelikow came out that he possibly took direction from Karl Rove, the Jersey Girls, the women who fought for the creation of the 9/11 Commission, called for a new investigation into the attacks. You know, and the media's not covering. How do you think America would react if they heard this news?
Well, I'm not sure. You know, it's been suggested to me by several different people, disparate, certainly, even people not from this country, that one of the reasons there is such vehement resistance to even entertaining, even momentarily, the idea that the official story is an absolute lie is because it would call into question every single thing, whether we're left or right, Democrat or Republican, liberal or conservative, doesn't make any difference. It would call into question the very foundations of what we've come to believe in this society, and we simply could not handle that massive a cognitive dissonance. I've never, you know, I've been kind of an observer for the past 7 years. I've stayed out of this debate for the most part. I've stayed, and I'm going to put you on hold for a second and come back because we've I'm talking right through your time, John. But let me put you on hold. I've tried to stay out of this because I didn't know where to go with it. And I know that everybody on this issue is utterly convinced that their point of view is the only point of view, and any opposing point of view is only put out there by crazy people. You know, just crazy people or fools. So, but you know, I've opened the door now, and it's going to stay open. We'll be right back.
Should I stay and pretend that?
The Mike Malloy Show. Talk radio matters here.
It's about 25 before the hour. We're talking with John Gold, who's called in from Philly. John, I'm very embarrassed. I didn't realize you were the John Gold of 911blogger.com. My apologies.
Oh, yeah, no, that's okay.
Go ahead.
One point I wanted to make is you were saying that people wouldn't be able to handle the truth, essentially. I think Americans and people of the world are capable of handling it. You were looking for a way to phrase making 9/11 the core issue. And 9/11 is the day that created the post-9/11 world.
Right.
The post-9/11 world is a world where civil liberties can disappear, our Constitution could be trashed, the country could be bankrupted, we can go fight in preemptive wars around the world. I mean, if 9/11 was not what we were led to believe, and it sure as hell does seem that way, then we should know about it, and we should know about it now. I have a series of films. There are 10 films on YouTube.com called 9/11 Truth, What's Being Covered Up? And it's 10 different family members, you know, asking their questions, and I hope people go take a look at it.
All right, so it's YouTube. Go to YouTube, and then and how is it titled?
It's 9/11 Truth, : What's Being Covered Up, or you can just go to the user gold9472.
Okay.
And I wanted to say thank you, Michael, for covering this issue in the coming week.
Yeah, I'll be in touch, John, via email. I'm sure there's some information you can provide, or some people that we might have on as a guest, or you yourself.
Well, there are several experts. You know, I highly recommend Bob McElveen, family members, Lori Van Alken. You know, these people were involved in the process from the beginning. But at a time when their government refused to do any investigation, they had to go down into Washington, D.C., at a time when their kids were traumatized, and fight for an investigation. What That should speak volumes to people, the fact that this administration did not want to investigate the attack. You know, everybody should ask themselves, why on earth would this president, the person you would think would want to know exactly how and why this happened so as to make sure it never happens again, did not want to investigate?
You know, that's probably, it's not the linchpin, but it is one of the most intriguing and mind-blowing aspects of everything that we've come to know in a package as 9/11 is the fact that the president and the vice president did everything they could to stop an investigation, and then when it could not be stopped, agreed to show up and testify only together and only not under oath. But going back to the what you just said, that to think that the President of the United States would do everything he could to prevent an investigation, I mean, this is just to me that's I'm sorry, that's a smoking gun. That's a clear indication of complicity. Either,
well, but then they stacked the deck of the 9/11 Commission. They put Philip Zelikow.
Right.
You know, the entire investigation was a sham. They were mandated to give a full and complete accounting
right.
of the 9/11 attack.
Right.
And everything that, you know, that wasn't mentioned shows that they failed miserably. Sabel Edmonds, the Pakistani ISI, the war games that were taking place that day.
Right.
You know, these things were not investigated. Whistleblowers. There were numerous whistleblowers who came forward that the 9/11 Commission told the family members they would hear. They didn't. And, you know, Patty Casaza, one of the Jersey Girls this past November, indicated that the information these whistleblowers had showed that this government knew the day, the target, and the type of attack.
Mm-hmm.
You know, don't you think these people should have been interviewed by the 9/11 Commission?
Yes.
And they weren't.
Yeah.
So.
Well, we're go- like I said earlier tonight, John. We're going to do this, and I'm certainly one of the least informed media people out here. I think of all the who believes that it was either a false flag operation or there was complicitness in.
Well, you know, I've been doing this for almost 6 years now, and I honestly don't know what happened on 9/11. I don't know.
Yeah,
and
well,
that's part of the problem.
Right. Well, I don't either, and I'm starting with only one preconceived notion, and that is, we don't know the truth. You know,
I think they've earned the title of suspect for the crimes of 9/11.
Yeah, well,
absolutely.
I'll go along with that. All right, I guess I can get in touch with you through your website.
Yeah, that's fine. Just go to 9/11 Blogger.
Okay, and we'll be in touch. And thanks for checking in, John. I appreciate it.
Thanks for what you're doing, Mike.
All right, take care. Take care. I can remember what John was just talking about, how when it came out in mainstream media that there was to be no investigation, and the group of widows known sort of affectionately as the Jersey Girls insisting and pushing and pushing and pushing and providing testimony, I believe. Didn't they appear before congressional committees prior to the formation of this phony-ass 9/11 investigation commission, whatever it was called, the one that they first wanted Henry Kissinger to chair? Jesus Christ. And I remember thinking at the time, how could the President of the United States, subsequent to the most vicious attack on U.S. soil in modern American history, not want an investigation? I mean, what does that mean? What is implied by that? Now, immediately to me, you know, I go for the low-hanging fruit, as they say. Immediately to me, what that means is he was involved and just didn't want his complicity in this event to come out. Now, whether that's true or not is immaterial, because that's just, like I say, that was my first reaction. Well, hell no, he didn't want the truth to come out because he's involved in it. What else are you going to think when you're, like I am, you know, very emotionally, a hair trigger emotionally about this? Because like every American, you know, I remember getting my particular phone call that morning here in Atlanta from my daughter in Tampa, who wanted to, she said, Daddy, you're watching CNN. So there's just so much. And I understand that a lot of people are going to email me. I've gotten, maybe 10 emails this evening, maybe 150 emails in support of this idea, maybe 10 saying, come on, don't do, you know, this is this is crazy stuff. And my only response to that is, again, the only preconceived notion I'm starting with here is that I've been lied to by the government. And I wonder if everyone who is saying to me via email, don't do this, don't do this, do you all completely accept the story? And here's the thing. You've got to accept the whole thing. I mean, you can't pick and choose here. You've got to accept or not accept the official U.S. government 9/11 story. You can't parse it. You can't say, well, this part of it's true, but that isn't. Because it's of a whole piece. The whole thing, 19 people came to the United States, boarded aircraft, defeated every single security system this country had in place on September 11, 2000, and maybe we didn't have a single security system in place. But whatever was in place, they defeated it. They hijacked 1, 2, 3, 4 jetliners. Nobody tried to stop them. Nobody. And they wreaked the hell that they wreaked. Now, if you want to believe that, if you want to accept that at face value, who am I to tell you that perhaps you're mistaken? But I'm not going to go there. I haven't gone there in, I think maybe the first day I sat there and was dumbfounded. Yeah, 19 hijackers just invaded the United States, 15 of them from Saudi Arabia, and just beat my country, just knocked it on its ass. Maybe for the first 24 hours, maybe 48, maybe the first week. Hell, maybe the first 6 months. I don't know. Until I started reading, what was that book by the French writers, Kathy? The French intelligence guy and the French journalist. Well, remember that? That was the first time, and I think we were still working for IE America at the time. And somebody sent me a copy of the book, and I read maybe half of it. And all of a sudden, that was a book that laid out what was told to the Taliban in Houston, Texas, prior to our invading Afghanistan. And they were told, we'll either pave your streets with gold or we'll bomb you into the Stone Age or something, something to that effect. Damn it, I wish I could think of the title of the book. Forbidden Truth. Forbidden Truth, that was the name of it. And I read that and I thought, wait a second. Wait a minute. What the hell? So I guess that was when I hit the wall. You know, the secret oil diplomacy that was going on at the time, and yada yada yada. But as one of my emailers said, most people, I don't think rational people just start out immediately saying on September 12th. Holy Jesus Christ, look what the Bush crime family just did. No, I don't think, unless that particular person, I guess there's some people who could do that who are extremely paranoid and expecting all sorts of booger men to jump out from behind the bushes and the curtains. But at some point, I think rational, reasonable, intelligent people stop and say, wait a second. Wait, just a minute. What is it I'm supposed to believe now? This is what I'm saying. No, thank you. Not going to do it. Forget the ones who died on that Tuesday morning, and we're going to stand up and see it through.
defend who still today. 'Cause we'll never fall when we all stand. God bless the USA.
About 8 and a half before the hour. Thanks for hanging out tonight, and thanks to the crew. Ian Huff, who engineered the program and handled the phone calls tonight. Billy Foster, our technical director. Ben Birch is the podcast manager. Chris in Minnesota, our senior correspondent. Bob Alexander, our resident philosopher. Bridget Wolf, writer in residence. In a new addition to the lineup tonight, Sharon Gordy is our military affairs correspondent. Catherine Bay is the executive producer of this program. Tim is calling from Branson, Missouri. Welcome to the program, Tim.
Hi there.
Hey.
I think my phone just beat because it's going to take me off the... My battery's going to die. I've been waiting, so I think I've got about 30 seconds. All I'm going to say is check out 911truth.org. And that's along your last caller. It's right along the lines of intelligent research. It'll really help you out.
Okay.
911truth.org. It's a very well-done site with lots of links of professors and engineers and airline pilots and all kinds of intelligent people. It'll just really open your eyes about what you're suspecting to be true.
Yeah, I think I've gone there before, but I'm definitely going to use that as a major resource.
Okay. So my phone's going to die, so I'll just take off, and I really appreciate your show.
All right. Thanks. Thanks, Tim. I appreciate you checking in. Thanks very much. You know, another reason that I've, you know, hesitated to really go into this topic is... I get overwhelmed with information sometimes. You know, when I'm getting ready to do a show, you know, I've said before, we'll kind of keep track of what's happening during the day, and then at various points during the day, as stories start to develop that just based on my experience of working in news, I know it's going to be a major story for the day. We'll start doing some research, maybe just light research. Contemporary news reports, and maybe a little bit deeper. Let's see what was available on this topic within the past couple months. And then if it's really something involved, we'll go to LexisNexis search or something to that effect. Anytime I have gone to some of the 9/11 investigative websites, it's just also overwhelming. I mean, you can go to any one of these, and all of a sudden you're confronted with 50, 60 videos and news reports, and one thing leads to another, and it's just so much. And so that's just one of the reasons that, you know, I've said before, I like to make sure that, at least to the best I'm able, to make sure that what I put out in this program is not just jive turkey nonsense. And when I have made these mistakes, sometimes glaring mistakes, I'll come back on the next day and say, oops, and correct it, do a mea culpa. But when you start checking into 9/11, yeah, there might be a lot of kooky stuff out there. I don't know. Maybe it's not so kooky. You know, who knows? Who among us back in 1965 or 64 did not believe that the Gulf of Tonkin incident didn't really happen? I can remember that night seeing it on television. I do remember that. And then that's about 6 months later is when I got my draft notice. It just, And then to find out that the whole thing was a lie. You know, the whole thing was a lie. To know that this administration has lied us into two wars that have cost the lives of hundreds of thousands of people solidifies for me the truth that anything they say is a lie, or everything they say is a lie is another way of putting it. Everything that this administration says is a lie. If they have an official version of the events of 9/11, it is by definition a lie. It has to be, because this is an administration that lies about everything. There's no way to weasel out of that. You can't get out of that. An administration that will lie a country into war will lie about everything. You don't have to be a genius to figure that out or to come to that conclusion. So we're going to pursue it. We're going to continue and not pursue it. I'm not trying to break new ground here at all. I just think that what we need to do is talk about what has already come up, or what has been brought up by with a lot of research. Some of it good, some of it not so good. I don't know, not until we get into it. I just do know from seeing some of these lists of people who have worked on this, there's some very, very intelligent people who and expert people in their fields have said, no, this is a lie. I'll see you tomorrow night. Thanks for hanging out. I'm Mike Malloy. This is Nova M. Keep it lit.